has now accumulated enough pledged delegates to the Democratic convention so that no matter how unpopular he is among Democrats, no matter how unpopular he is as a candidate, he has enough delegates to secure the nomination. The only way that he can really be removed as a Democratic candidate is if he were to step down. In which case, all of the delegates who are pledged to vote for him on the first ballot would then be released, and you'd have other candidates who could step in.
Well, we're going to leave it there, but I want to thank you for being with us. Reid Brody is a war crimes prosecutor and author of To Catch a Dictator, The Pursuit and Trial of Hissein Habre. We're going to continue the conversation and post online at democracynow.org and also talk about the ICJ decision, the International Court of Justice. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Shufa Dokadus, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warren, Sharina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, Dennis McCormick, Matt Ely, Anna Uzbek. Our website is democracynow.org. You can get our podcasts there. Thank you so much for joining us.
OO Portland on 90.
Plugged In on KBOO is a radio show dedicated to underground electronic music. The show is hosted by DJ Tronic and features deep house, tech house, techno, drum and bass, breakbeats, future bass, downtempo, and more. Plugged In frequently has local producers and DJs on the show, and we provide info about upcoming events in Portland, including free ticket giveaways. Plugged In airs the first and third Friday of every month from 10 p.m. to 12 a.m. Pacific time.
KBOO Community Radio couldn't do it without you. Support KBOO by becoming a member during our spring membership drive, taking place now through May 25th. Your contribution goes towards postmodern, avant-garde, alternative radio. Donate now by going to kboo.fm/give. Thank you.
Some of the proposed solutions that's coming from the grassroots level.
You're listening to Making Contact.
I'm Salima Hamrani, and on today's Making Contact.
If you don't accept these terms and conditions as Global South country, you will not get a single vaccine dose. That was the condition.
We learn about how unequal vaccine access across the world left poor countries at the mercy of powerful pharmaceutical companies, and also why attempts to level that playing field have failed.
The WTO affirmed a kind of really weak, unusable, and watered-down version of this original TRIPS waiver that had been proposed for vaccines at a time when not only did nobody need the solution itself that they proposed was too weak to actually be implemented, and that's the best summary I can give.
But we also look at the ways the Global South is fighting back and ensuring that they're not on their own during the next global pandemic. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up.
So basically, we believe that our sovereignty was taken away at the behest of very powerful pharmaceutical companies who are unelected and basically hold no public office in our country. And this should never happen again.
Welcome to Making Contact. You're listening to Fatima Hassan, a human rights lawyer in South Africa and founder and director of Health Justice Initiative. And we're starting our show with a huge court victory that the Health Justice Initiative won last year. And let me explain. When the pandemic first started, South Africa had been waiting and waiting and waiting for vaccines that they'd been promised.
Well, South Africa has the continent's highest number of coronavirus cases, but so far it has only vaccinated 1% of its population.
South Africa is battling a second wave of the disease. So far, tens of thousands of healthcare workers have contracted the virus and more than 430 have died. The need for a vaccine is now more urgent than ever.
Those vaccines never came to us for months. We were wondering where they were. We were waiting for supplies. We had a drip feed of supplies.
A drip of vaccines was just not enough because people were dying. So activists started to ask questions about what had happened to the medicines that they had been assured would keep them alive.
Day one, we were told, participate in clinical trials. Day one, we were told, put funding on the table to support accelerated vaccine research. We're all in this together. What happened? The total opposite.
So to get answers, Health Justice Initiative took the South African government to court to open the contracts that they signed with Johnson & Johnson and other pharmaceutical companies like Pfizer.
Because we had to go to court to demand transparency. Nobody else, it was civil society and NGO that had to go to court to fight for these contracts to be opened.
And they succeeded in opening the contracts in September of 2023. And here's what they found. First, South Africa had to pay marked up prices. The vaccines were more expensive for South Africa than for Europe or Australia, for example, even though South Africa is significantly less wealthy. Second, they had to pay a certain amount upfront in the billions with no guarantee of timely delivery, which means that sometimes they had to wait months for vaccines they'd already paid for. And third, they couldn't resell or donate any of the vaccine doses.
The terms and conditions in these contracts and agreements are so one-sided and so in favor of multinational corporations that it has placed governments, including South Africa, in the unenviable position of having to secure scarce supplies in a global emergency in a manner which basically can only be described as a set of ransom negotiations.
South Africa got bamboozled, but one health official who was involved in the contract negotiations said that they had no choice.
He described that the government felt like it was held to ransom in order to access vaccine doses.
And there's that term again, held to ransom, and that's Piotr Kolchinski.
I'm an EU health policy advisor at the People's Vaccine Alliance.
The People's Vaccine Alliance is part of a network of organizations that's helping change the narrative around the fair distribution of medicines around the world. And they work closely with the Health Justice Initiative. Piotr says that the situation in South Africa is unfortunately not unique.
And we are hearing these stories from South America to Asia. And governments in Latin America, for example, they accused Pfizer of bullying in vaccine negotiations.
In some cases, Pfizer even asked countries to put up sovereign assets as collateral in case anyone sued for vaccine injury down the line.
So in that sense, the private sector has been effectively driving the pandemic response. And this power imbalance that I'm talking about was particularly striking for countries in the global south.
If you don't accept these terms and conditions as global south country, you will not get a single vaccine dose. That was the condition. So that's why we call it bullying. That's why we say apartheid. That's why we say vaccine nationalism. That's why we say never again.
A few years ago, we produced a piece about the lack of COVID-19 vaccine access around the world. And back then, the situation was pretty dismal. Rich countries were first in line for a life-saving vaccine. Poor countries were last. And today we're doing an update. And as you just heard, things haven't gotten any better. But as time wears on, and as we face the prospect of more pandemics in the future, people in the global south are losing patience with rich countries, pharmaceutical companies, and patent monopolies. They want change, and here's how they're going to get it. Joining us today is Achal Prabhula. He's a coordinator of the Access IBSA project. He works on intellectual property and how it affects the fair distribution of medicine globally. Achal, welcome back to Making Contact. Really happy to have you back on. And for people who may not have heard our last show that we did on this topic, can you talk about what happened back in 2020, 2021 with the rollout of the vaccines to the global south?
Yeah, sure. I'd love to do this. Look, when the pandemic was declared, this was 2020 in March, it immediately became clear that the only way out of this pandemic really would be through pharmaceuticals. Pharmaceuticals that could either treat COVID successfully and therefore render it ineffective or vaccines that could prevent us from getting COVID. And in fact, those were the very first kinds of investments, the big investments that governments made, especially in Europe and the United States. When this was happening, we had a good 6 months to a 7 month run up, I would say. I and a number of other activists were working as best as we could with public health authorities, with large development organizations that purportedly cared about public health, as well as governments, our own in poor countries. I'm from India. I work in South Africa and Brazil, and I engaged with all three governments at the time, as well as rich country governments that I don't have much influence over, like the United States and Europe, to say that monopolies are going to come in your way. I know this because I'd worked on exactly such monopolies for 20 years. I'd begun working with HIV and AIDS in South Africa at the turn of the century. By the time I started working in South Africa, AIDS had become what we call a chronic condition. It was no more dangerous or deadly than diabetes. And yet, a large percentage of people who were HIV positive and developed AIDS in South Africa were dying. And the reason they were dying is not because there weren't drugs that could treat them. The reason they weren't getting those drugs is because they were just too expensive. And the only reason these drug companies could get away with doing something like pricing it that much out of the reach of the majority of people around the world who needed these drugs was because of pharmaceutical monopolies in the form of patents.
And intellectual property rights in the form of patents did become a problem during COVID almost immediately.
The vaccines did appear by the end of 2020, early 2021. They went out into the world in the most unequal manner possible. The lowest income countries in Asia and sub-Saharan Africa received nearly no vaccines at all for months on end. Poor countries, but yet countries that were better off with vaccine manufacturing capacity, such as India, South Africa, others, did have some vaccines being produced within the country that they could use, but they were much fewer. And the range of vaccines was also just far smaller the poorer the country you lived in. And so if you lived in Europe or the United States, you had your sort of full choice of a couple of different leading vaccines. If you lived in a poor country, at best, you had one or two vaccines that you had some kind of delayed access to. And if you lived in the poorest countries in the world, you just had nothing at all. This was an inexcusable situation, but it also, in a respiratory viral pandemic, it was the kind of thing that really hurt them too. And so this idea that Europe or America could save itself by vaccinating itself and sort of damn the world didn't really work out. And the reason it didn't work out is that these viruses don't actually understand borders. And what they did, especially in places where there were very low vaccination rates and existing public health problems, is that they mutated. So they mutated into something called Delta, a variant in India, which then rapidly spread around the world and became the world's dominant viral strain. They mutated into something called Omicron, which was first detected in Southern Africa and then rapidly spread around the world and then became the dominant strain in the world.
Live samples of COVID-19 are handled in a secure South African laboratory. Scientists here are racing to understand more about a sudden surge of mutations. The virus has already become far more infectious. There are signs it may also have at least some resistance to current vaccines.
So one way to have contained these mutations and an endless prolonging of the pandemic would have been to vaccinate everybody at the same time. Instead, what the West deliberately chose, because there's no other way to put it, is to vaccinate itself and then produce these booster vaccines, which were reformulations, essentially new vaccines for new viral mutations of, you know, the original virus, which again went only to them, right? But this is the sordid history of both the inequity that existed in the pandemic and then beyond.
There were some attempts at evening the playing field. For example, COVAX. COVAX was created to help poor countries access vaccinations. The idea is that we'd be able to vaccinate the global south using money and medicine donated by charitable organizations. I asked Piotr why it failed.
COVAX was initially meant to be a program in which both high-income countries and low-income countries would participate. But the countries from the global north, like US, like the EU, they didn't want to participate in the end.
Instead, the Global North just began signing contracts on the side with pharmaceutical companies to buy up massive amounts of vaccines.
COVAX effectively was with no doses to distribute to low and middle income countries, because in the first phase of the pandemic, when they became available, they were all hoarded by the global north countries.
It's not the only program that was meant to help the global south that seems to have failed. In our last show, we talked about an exciting idea that activists began floating at the international level because they saw how damaging patents were to public health.
The governments of South Africa and India, but really the government of South Africa actually, decided to float this very exciting proposal at the World Trade Organization, which they called a TRIPS waiver.
TRIPS stands for Trade-Related Aspects of Intellectual Property Rights, which, well, doesn't really explain what it means.
The provision is to allow member countries of the WTO to suspend pharmaceutical monopolies during the pandemic. Why? So that countries then could have the ability to manufacture the drugs and the vaccines that they need in order to live, but also the diagnostics, the tests, many of which are monopolized.
Achal, you know, last time we talked, you were really excited about the TRIPS waiver and you thought it really had potential. And it seems like finally, after a long wait, something was passed, but it wasn't what you were expecting.
This is a long and sad story. I think what happened at the WTO was that a very useful proposal was made before vaccines came to market, I should just note. So this was October 2020, and the only people who had vaccines in the market then were the Chinese and the Russians. It was a solution that was needed to be implemented yesterday, even when it was proposed in October 2020. Yes. Was it implemented in October 2020? No. Was it implemented in October 2021? No. Instead, it just went on and on and on and on and really past the point of no return at a time when honestly nobody particularly cared about COVID. Everybody was relieved to be able to return to some semblance of normal life when honestly no Americans or Europeans were even taking the many multiple boosters that their governments had spent billions on creating for them. It was that over. By that point, the WTO affirmed a kind of really weak, unusable, and watered-down version of this original TRIPS waiver that had been proposed for vaccines at a time when not only did nobody need the solution itself that they proposed was too weak to actually be implemented. And that's the best summary I can give of a really long, really tragic, ultimately pointless, and a totally catastrophic exercise.
There's an important lesson to be learned here, and a lesson activists are facing head-on again, this time at the World Health Organization. And we're going to talk about what's happening at the WHO right after the break. We're just jumping in to remind you that you're listening to Making Contact. If you like today's show and want more information, please visit us online at radioproject.org. We have links to articles and important projects on this topic, such as a report from the Health Justice Initiative on the lessons we should have learned as a global community from the pandemic. Check it out if you have time. And now, back to the show. Welcome back to Making Contact. I'm Salima Hamrani. Today, we are revisiting a topic we focused on in 2021. Vaccine and medical access for COVID around the world. In the first half of the show, our main guest, Achal Prabala, told us why the early attempts at fair distribution of vaccines failed. In the second half of the show, we wanted to look at two current ideas that activists are working on in the aftermath of the TRIPS waiver. And here's the first. So it looks like there's another new multinational agreement that's being debated at the World Health Organization called the Pandemic Treaty. Can you talk to me about what the Pandemic Treaty is and why it's important?
I'd love to do that. The Pandemic Treaty is something that I've been following closely. I don't work on it within Geneva itself because I live in Bangalore and I work out of here. But I'm absolutely committed to the treaty itself, to its success. Why? Because it's the first time after this pandemic that there's been a serious, thoughtful, intellectual exercise grounded in reason, participated in by every single country in the world, where people are trying now seriously to put together an infrastructure that is better suited to the next pandemic in order to make the next one less catastrophic than the one that just passed. And the beauty of a pandemic treaty and exercises such as this, I think, is that even in the absence of the next pandemic, right, in the years before the next pandemic, it's the kind of thing that offers us a bunch of different really commonsensical, sound building blocks to effective public health. So the kinds of things that work as infrastructure for the next pandemic also work as infrastructure for us staying alive between this pandemic and the next one, right?
What are the conditions that most countries want included in the pandemic treaty? Well, there's one huge condition that would have made a big difference during COVID.
What everyone is saying in the world is, let's not create monopolies in pharmaceuticals and vaccines in the first place. Let's do our best not to have a monopoly on these things. And if in the next pandemic there is something that has a monopoly on it, let's allow people to override them as easily as possible.
So what would that look like? Well, let's take a recent example.
In the last pandemic, the US government gave a no risk, no conditions attached, 1 billion plus research and development grant to Moderna to fully fund its efforts to create an mRNA vaccine for COVID. By Moderna's own admission in their own financial reports, this $1 billion plus dollar grant covered all of their research and development costs at no risk, which is to say, had they failed, they would have been liable for zero at the end of it, right? Of course, they didn't fail. They made an mRNA vaccine, which is to tremendous credit to them. Unfortunately, what they did with their achievement was they tied it behind the fiercest monopoly protection in the world and made sure that absolutely no one, except for the richest people in the world, and then the next richest people in the world, got those vaccines when they needed them. So what the pandemic treaty is suggesting is that when the next time when the US government sends $1 billion to a pharmaceutical company to create a product, put in conditions that say, hey, we can then figure out, if you're successful, how to make your vaccine or your pharmaceutical available to everyone in the world. We can force you to license capable suppliers around the world of making the same pharmaceutical or vaccine in order not just to save people in other countries, but also to save ourselves, right? The United States government is opposing this. The European Union is opposing similar kinds of conditions. This is an incredible tragedy because I think that patience is wearing thin.
The pandemic treaty is going down the same road as the TRIPS waiver. It's getting watered down and watered down into an almost useless document.
This is one of those instances where I sincerely hope we get nothing rather than something, because to have in place a ridiculous, watered down, ineffective, pointless, meaningless document that masquerades as a pandemic treaty, providing some kind of false assurances to people, preventing them from doing anything actual and real about the next pandemic, I would much prefer us not to have a treaty, to be reminded every single day that we have no scaffolding, no infrastructure, no protection against the next pandemic when it appears. I actually think that's better for us in terms of our own vigilance and protection for the future, rather than having something ridiculous that has no meaning.
Here's Piotr again.
And this is very concerning. Because while the EU and US and other rich countries claim that the lessons learned from the COVID-19 pandemic needs to be learned, they refuse to go beyond the existing structures and policies that perpetuate global inequalities.
Hearing activists talk about their disillusion with the pandemic treaty made me wonder if it's even worth it, trying to create these international agreements, because the West and pharmaceutical companies seem to overpower the will of the rest of the planet every single time.
Definitely, it may seem like the World Health Organization is more democratic, more equitable space than the World Trade Organization. But you're right, the power played by the rich countries, the US, EU, UK, Japan, Switzerland, which basically represents the interests of its own industry, makes it's very difficult to reach an agreement that will make access to medicines more equitable. So while I think it is important for countries to engage in these processes and trying to change the international framework, countries should not forget about the power they've got at national level.
And while we'll be keeping an eye on the pandemic treaty and continue hoping for a landmark resolution between all countries on how to share medicine and treatments, we're also turning our attention to what Piotr just mentioned, the power that the Global South can build so that it doesn't have to depend on the West. And there's actually a really exciting new idea that's already working. It's called the mRNA Technology Transfer Protocol. And I wanted to end the show with some good news because the global stage can look increasingly dismal and frightening when we're thinking about the next pandemic. Here's Achal explaining what the mRNA Technology Transfer Protocol is.
In the wake of Moderna and BioNTech saying, hey, we make mRNA, no one else will, we're not sharing anything with anyone, what they're doing is painfully and painstakingly recreating mRNA technology from scratch. And what they recreate from scratch is being shared with every single one of their partners.
And a quick note on mRNA technology. It's really important to understand that despite how controversial they may be now, mRNA vaccines were a huge medical breakthrough. In the past, vaccines were extremely difficult, dangerous, and expensive to produce.
Vaccines are biologic drugs, and these are complex molecules because they contain a much, much more complicated and sometimes varying biological and chemical formula to express them, whereas something that comes in the form of a pill, typically, like an antiretroviral drug, is something that can be expressed with a chemical formula. Yes, so that's the basic difference between what we call a small molecule, like an antiretroviral drug, and a large molecule or a biologic, like a vaccine. And this cell-based biology had to be painstakingly produced in a linear process that you could not avoid. You had to grow them in eggs or yeast. You had to manage them in incredibly sophisticated lab facilities that required high levels of safety protocols.
Which is why, for a long time, across the world, there's only been a handful of vaccine manufacturers. But that's about to change.
And then suddenly, you know, you had this thing called mRNA that came along, which actually had no cell-based biology. And so suddenly you had sort of like the digital equivalent of vaccines, right? After a long analog world of vaccines.
Since mRNA technology doesn't require the use of cells, they're much easier to produce and more uniform.
You don't have to, you know, worry about things like variants, whether there are slight differences in the cells. This is entirely a process that's predictable and calculated.
Which means that now, much like HIV drugs during the AIDS crisis, the Global South has the ability to create mRNA vaccines on their own at a much cheaper cost.
That was the revolutionary potential of mRNA. And it is literally the only silver lining that came out of the pandemic, in my opinion.
In terms of vaccines, the Global South has never had an opportunity quite like this. And they're planning to take full advantage of it. They want to use the technology to create a COVID vaccine as an experiment, but the real target is a wide range of underfunded vaccines for diseases that commonly plague poor countries.
Like, for example, HIV, tuberculosis, Rift Valley fever, West Nile fever, and other critical diseases that's important to the African continent and to other low-income countries and for which no vaccines are currently available.
That's Petro Terblanche.
I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Afrigen Biologics. Afrigen is a Cape Town-based biotechnology company.
Afrigen is the host of the mRNA Technology Transfer Center. The company was already researching vaccines for things like tuberculosis, another neglected global disease. So they jumped at the idea of creating an mRNA vaccine hub. One of the huge disparities that has always plagued the Global South is the lack of manufacturing, which leaves places like the continent of Africa very, very vulnerable during pandemics.
The African continent uses about 25% of all vaccines manufactured globally, but we only have the ability to manufacture 1% of what we need. So this initiative is part of the African Union and the African Center for Disease Control to manage and build a sector on the continent that will be able to supply at least 60% of the vaccines that we need by 2040. So it's an ambitious program.
And they've made a lot of progress already. They even have a vaccine candidate ready to go.
We are completing our safety studies, preclinical, and we'll go to non-human primate studies before we do our clinical trial in humans early in 2025. We have indicated and demonstrated in preclinical development that the vaccine candidate AfriVac 2121 is comparable in safety and immunogenicity to the current registered COVID vaccines.
The vaccine that they've created is actually based on the original COVID strain, and so it won't be used, just tested to see if the lab and the techniques that they've built are actually working. If it does work, they can scale up to build a repository of vaccines for all kinds of diseases.
We're using the same platform now to work on tuberculosis and HIV and other vaccine candidates. So we call the original strain vaccine our workhorse. It will be used to validate the platform, but we will not take it to the clinic and final registration because there's no clinical indication for its use.
And all of it, the technology that they're creating, the facilities, the testing, it'll be shared with their partner countries in a completely collaborative process without patents.
First is to transfer knowledge as we progress it. We're already doing training, and 14 of our 15 partners have been to Afrigen and received the first knowledge transfer and training on mRNA technology. We're also providing and sharing the process layout. We're sharing the design of the facilities, and ultimately we will transfer the platform with all the analytics, all the assays and the process to our partners to enable them to either develop further vaccines or to manufacture mRNA vaccines.
Which means that coming into the next pandemic, whether or not the treaty fails at the WHO, poor countries can start producing and researching their own vaccines, ensuring that we might, as a global community, survive. And that does it for today's show. If you like today's piece on global vaccine access, please visit us online at radioproject.org to leave us a comment. I'm Salima Hamrani. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.